Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we're saving the world's natural balance in two intriguing ways. One way comes from our favorite British gastronaut, Stephen Gates. He's been exploring the nether regions of eating. The other approach comes from Freegans. Now, this group claims waste shouldn't be, and they do something about it. Now, both these takes suggest a single question. Is what we'll have to eat in the next couple of decades going to be tough to swallow, in every sense of the word? Or are we at the tipping point of a new ingenious and enticing way of eating and living? Well, stick around for more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, we've got food tours, wine tours, even specialized chili tours. And then there is the bug tour, taken by British gastronaut Stephen Gates. It was for the BBC documentary Alien Nation. Now, Stephen has a wonderfully curious turn of mind and a playful sense of science, as in his glow-in-the-dark jello. He's written the extraordinary cookbook, but this latest tour took him into new territory. Stephen, good to have you back with us.
It's great to speak to you again.
So have you given up the glow-in-the-dark jello in favor of bugs? And why?
Well, I'm fascinated by the secrets that food hides, whether it's fluorescing under ultraviolet light or whether there's something a little bit deeper. And I'm also fascinated by concepts like disgust. I love the fact that food leads us to discovering something profound about people and about ourselves and about morality and emotions. And insect eating is particularly fascinating because it's so paradoxical. It reveals a lot about ourselves, and I think it reveals a lot to myself about me. And on one side, insects are perfectly edible, they're nutritious, they've got a long and noble history in cooking. But reactions to them, especially in the West, especially amongst people that I know, and myself, to be honest, are often violently negative. And I wanted to find out, what does this mean? You know, these things are perfectly edible. Why are we disgusted? What is disgust? And what lies beneath it? And also, what does it tell us about the people who hunt and farm and eat them? I mean, what are your views? Just as a sort of starting point, what do you think about the idea of eating insects?
I have to say, intellectually, I see them as a source of protein. I know they're being looked at as an ecological solution to what's happening on the planet. And I try to be open-minded about it. But I hesitate, you know, crickets. I've never eaten a cricket. I've had, you know, it's always the chocolate covered business, that cheats. But the yuck factor comes into it, and I really don't like that about myself.
Well,
but
I have exactly the same thing. It's something that I look at myself. I mean, I've made lots of documentaries and programs around the world where I come across insects. They crop up in conversation, and especially when you're interviewing people who are poor or who are on the margins of society, and there's a lot of insect eating. And I try them, and on one level, I'm fascinated by what they taste like. What are they going to be like? Mm-hmm. I'm also very conscious that if somebody offers you food, it's a huge insult to turn it down, especially in marginalised peoples where they struggle to feed themselves well enough anyway. But also, to be perfectly honest, I partly eat it because I know it'll make great TV. And I, that's a shallowness in myself. And mm-hmm. and I really wanted to get to grips with it. Because as you say, there are lots more people now talking about insects as potentially a food of the future, potentially a way out of the planet's looming food crisis. Uh-huh. So I spent 10 days basically eating insects for every meal in a tour of Thailand and Cambodia, where there's a huge amount of insect eating.
I'd love to know, what were you tasting? What were you actually putting in your mouth, and how are you reacting to it?
Well, the most popular insects, the ones you find most, are, I would say, crickets, grasshoppers, and giant water bugs. Crickets are pretty small; they're about the size of the end of your thumb, and they're alive. They sit in these vast tubs, and they are usually dropped into water to drown them, and then thrown into hot oil. And uh-huh. they're fried. They're deep fried. So what you get is this very crispy. It's a taste that is full of umami. The thing about insects is because they have an exoskeleton, there's a huge amount of surface area to volume ratio, and so you get a huge amount of caramelization on the outside of it, on the legs and all the bits, and so you pop them in and they're crispy. They taste like crisps, or what you'd call potato chips. They're crunchy. They're tasty. They're always scattered with a mixture of salt, sugar, and a little bit of MSG. But it's pretty much a very recognisable flavour. Giant water bugs are a bit different. You deep fry them. You pull the back off, and underneath is a huge sort of swelling of green eggs. And you eat that bit. And I sort of thought that they tasted a little bit like pistachios. They're slightly nutty. Uh-huh. They look green. And so you've imposed this sort of taste upon it. And I ate them. They're also incredibly tough. It's like eating a big hunk of plastic. And so I ripped my throat apart the first time I tasted them. But they're everywhere. And you begin to eat them more as a snack. And as you throw yourself into it and you grind yourself down, you stop yourself from being disgusted, and you power through your own sense of sort of fear and ignorance,
right.
You begin to appreciate them for what they are.
On a scale of deliciousness, where it overcomes all of the, the suspicion, was there something or several things that just hit that piece of your sensibility?
Well, the grasshoppers are pretty good. They're the best of the small ones. Uh-huh. But the tarantulas, which taste of shrimp, they're okay. But the thing that blew my mind, which was an absolute cacophony of flavour and texture and taste, which really transcended anything else I've ever tasted, was a salad made from red ants and red ant eggs. And it's crunchy. The red ants are crunchy. The eggs are milky and sour. They're like an insect caviar, and they're in a delicious sort of salad dressing, which makes it a little bit sour. But it's this entire experience. You're sitting in a field in Cambodia with people that are so far away from you in terms of your own culture, and when you eat with them and you transcend your own sense of disgust, you reach a place where you dignify them so much more, and you dignify yourself because you show people a respect and you transcend your disgust, and then you become unjudgmental and sort of innocent all over again in sensual terms as much as cultural or moral terms. You've wiped your slate clean in a way, and it may sound overblown, but it feels like a sort of a rebirth of finding again what food sort of means.
It's remarkable. Stefan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stefan Gates is the author of The Extraordinary Cookbook, How to Make Meals Your Friends Will Never Forget. Now, to learn more about Stefan, go to the website, splendidtable.org. There's a saying, the rest of the world feasts on what America throws away. And then there's a statistic that could stop you in your tracks. 30-50% of our food production ends up in the trash. I mean, that's a pretty stunning number, especially in this economy. I mean, it's like saying our garbage is us. Well, this reality is growing the freegans movement. Freegans dumpster dive because of their beliefs. Journalist Scarlett Lindemann took months to dig into what this movement is about. Her article, Freegans, The Refined Art of Dumpster Diving, appeared in the journal Gastronomica. Scarlett, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So you actually went out and went dumpster diving with a group of freegans. What was that experience like?
Well, it was amazing and initially very shocking. If you have never dumpster dived before, I think it is impossible to comprehend just how much food, good food, is being thrown away. And it's really a visual shock. You have to do it to comprehend.
But it also is something that's so off-putting for people. You know, the idea of going into the garbage to look for food, and is that food safe, and how do you know? You know, all those things that come into your mind when you start to contemplate it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's very easy to understand the aversion and the disgust to dumpster diving. And I think eating from the trash, especially by choice, it's a complex and loaded act, one that transgresses public space and dining habits. And when it's done intentionally, it's even more taboo.
How do the people who do this, who believe in it, how do they actually go about doing it?
The people who do this may or may not self-identify as freegans, but freegans is a term that arose in the late to mid-1990s, a combination of free and vegan, though not all freegans are subscribed to a vegan diet.
Right.
But, they use food and food waste as sort of the core of their activism and their ecological consciousness. And there's a wide range of backgrounds, incomes, ages, and variance in how often people dumpster dive or how much they take from the trash. But they're all sort of linked together by wanting to waste less and becoming more self-sufficient and highlighting how much good food goes into the trash every day. So it depends on how often they go out, but they'll go out onto a New York City street, and New York City tends to be a great place to dumpster dive because all of the trash is set into the public realm on the sidewalk.
Right.
And it's not illegal. If you are careful, which many of the freegans are, they usually leave the garbage bags more tidy than when they first find them.
So what did you actually do when you went out with them? How does
this
happen?
Normally, they're organized through the internet. There are a number of meetup groups, Facebook groups, social media to organize. And they'll do sort of like dumpster diving 101, where they'll set a time and a place, and people, anyone, can come out and join and experience with them what it's like to dumpster dive. And they sort of guide and instruct along the way. So you meet up with them, and it's timed very carefully because they tend to know when stores throw their trash out. So they'll meet up at outside of a Trader Joe's, for example, or a supermarket on the Upper West Side, and carefully start to open the bags and pull through them. And they kind of can tell the certain bags by the weight and the feel. And after doing it so many times, you sort of understand what the contents may be or whether it's a good bag to open or not.
Uh-huh.
Some of them wear gloves, some of them don't, but you start to pull through, and sometimes supermarkets have compost bins where they will throw carrots and, you know, bruised apples, and you sort through and you pick and you inspect and you poke and maybe you smell. And, you know, you can lessen the risk by many of them don't take meat or dairy or eggs, but they pick and pare down stuff that they can probably cook later, like raw vegetables or packaged foods, which I think comprise the most amount of trash. Just so much food is thrown away from being bent or torn. The packaging is ripped or something spills on it, even though the food is, you know, inside safe, good to eat, it's unsellable.
Right. You talked about in the article, though, there's a very old heritage to this.
Absolutely. I think the practice of gathering cast off food is as old as agriculture, and there's a long history of gleaning, and though dumpster diving may look different from picking up forgotten potatoes in a field, it is essentially the same thing.
Interesting. It seems, too, that are there more people doing it now than were doing it before?
Maybe. I mean, with the current economic and environmental situation, I think this topic grows more salient. And as we all grapple with systemic excess, with food insecurity, with sustainability, I can only see that this would become more popular.
Yeah, interesting. Scarlett, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Scarlett Lindemann's article, Freegans, The Refined Art of Dumpster Diving, was published in the spring 2012 issue of Gastronomica. We're going to be back with the latest bun sensation from a new chef sensation and Alabama Eats, one memory at a time. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, here's my call on the next big thing. I think the next gem that we're going to see on chefy food trucks and infusion places is bao. Now, bao's already hitting the coasts, and we are going to love every bite as it sweeps the country. Bao is Asian. It's these little steam buns stuffed with all kinds of things. Eddie Wong is one of the masters of bao and of some intriguing writing and opinions. You could take a look at his video blog on vice.com. Eddie makes his living making bao at Bauhaus, his restaurant in New York. Eddie, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be on Splendid Table.
Well, okay, so you do these things called bao, right?
Mm-hmm.
B-A-O. What makes bao? What is bao? Because I've seen different things called by mm-hmm. that same name.
Yeah, well, bao just means bun or bread in Chinese. So, you know, it's even in the Vietnamese language. It's in Chinese. And the thing is that at the very core of bao is Asian sugar dough. So whether you're in East Asia, Southeast Asia, it's white steamed Asian sugar dough. And it comes from China, but it's kind of, you know, taken on various different forms and shapes and utilizations in all different parts of East and Southeast Asia.
But the bao I've been seeing a lot of, and it seems to be growing in popularity, is one that looks like a bun that's stuffed. One side
yes.
of it's open. It's almost like a hamburger roll, a little hamburger
yes.
roll that wasn't cut all the way through.
Yes. And that is a gua bao. And that shape where the bun looks like a taco slider hybrid Frankenstein combination
right,
comes
right.
from Taiwan. Yeah.
Ah, and that's where your family's from, right?
Yes. My father and my mother were both born in Taiwan. And so the gua bao is traditionally filled with braised pork belly. And that's the thing. You put braised pork belly, pickled mustard greens, cilantro, peanuts, and Taiwanese red sugar. And that is the quintessential Taiwanese sandwich.
That sounds so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot tell you. Are there traditional fillings for each kind of bao? You know, the ones
yes.
that you stuff like a dumpling and other forms of it?
Yeah, and I like to talk about bao at the most base level. So at the most base level is mantou, which is using the same dough. And mantou is just a big block of Asian sugar dough steamed. And most of the time it's formed in a block or it'll be twirled. So it'll kind of curl up and you can see the shape of it.
Uh-huh.
And that is kind of our equivalent to the bagel. So a lot of times when describing Asian food, I like to draw parallels to Jewish food because there's so many similarities. And then my grandfather used to sell those in Taiwan and in China. So my family kind of, you know, 50, 60 years ago, they were making the bagel, and then now we're kind of doing the slider, the Taiwanese version.
So this bagel style, this twist, really, how was that eaten? Was it dipped in a sauce? You know, did it have something on top of it? Or was it just the bread?
That's a great question. It is just bread. It's very proletariat food, but you always eat it with hot soy milk or mi jiang, which is a rice and peanut drink. So, you know, when it's cold in the morning in Beijing or wherever you are, you wake up in the morning, you drink a soy milk, and you have a mantou.
Ah.
All right, now we've got the round steamed buns that you find in the dim sum places. What are the traditional fillings there?
So the traditional filling in an enclosed bao that looks like a dumpling with a knot on the top would be cha so bao, and that is the red caramelized roasted pork that's inside. And then you'll also at times have pork and Chinese chives, yellow chives. And then you'll also have a shu bao, which is yellow Chinese chives, some egg, some mung bean noodles and such. And it's a vegetarian version.
And then one
thing I forgot to bring up, too, is with the mantou, which is the kind of bagel form, they'll also sometimes cut it open or stuff it with dried pork sung, which is like a very, very popular kind of topping that we use in congee, on any sorts of bread. We'll put it in rice balls. But dried pork sung is kind of the proletariat protein jerky of choice in East Asia.
So it's a pork jerky, actually?
Yeah, it's a dried pork jerky that's kind of shredded. Sometimes you'll see the translation as pork floss or pork sung.
Pork floss. Could you spell that?
Yeah, pork floss is P-O-R-K space F-L-O-S-S. And the brand that I like is Formosa brand from Taiwan.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. And what does it
taste? It's really good.
What does it taste like?
You know, it's interesting, and this is one thing that I always find interesting about Asian food is that we like to do things that I call sweet meat, meaning we always have a little more sugar in our savory dishes than maybe American food does until you go to the South. In the South, they really understand this concept of sweet meat as well. But
right. The
pork floss is it has that savory umami and the essence of pork, and then it has the kind of base notes from the animal protein, and it has a little soy component to it as well. It's kind of sweet and savory, and it's just a great jerky topping.
So as far as making this bun now, is there a particular technique? It's a steamed bread, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it sort of a straight white yeast bread with sugar at it?
It is, and it's a little bit of sugar at it. It's very much like Wonder Bread. In a lot of ways, if you Google and find an Asian sugar dough recipe and a Wonder Bread recipe, they're very, very similar.
Yeah, because that's what it always reminds me of, except the fillings are just amazing. And that seems to be the big deal now. Everybody's doing these cross-cultural or very inventive fillings. Are you into that as well?
I'll be honest. I'm really not too into the cross-cultural fillings. Like, we've done a few, and people liked it, and it was very interesting. But at the end of the day, after running those specials for a year with different flavors, I said, you know what? Why give people options that I wouldn't want to eat on a daily basis? You know, so I kind of started to limit the options at the restaurant because I want people to eat it in what I feel is the best form, which is that pork belly. And I love a Taiwanese fried chicken chop inside of it. So I really like to keep a Taiwanese flavor profile with my baos. And also because that Asian sugar dough is so unique. It has a very, very particular flavor, especially because we steam ours in lotus leaves. So if you buy these baos at the Chinese grocery store, it's totally fine to buy them frozen. The quality is not affected. Try to steam them in lotus leaves. The lotus leaves will give it flavor, and they'll give it a little interesting color too, and it kind of has a nose to it like rose water or jasmine when it comes out of the steamer.
Wonderful. And you can usually find those at Chinese markets, Asian markets as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lotus leaves are very, very – it's not an Asian market if you don't have lotus leaves.
And are they usually frozen?
No. The lotus leaves come dried and you want to steep them. It's a very simple steeping process. The baos do usually come frozen, and I'm telling you, like, that's how most people are making them. You know, like, the sugar dough is so simple. It's almost like if you went to a Texas barbecue place or Arthur Bryant's and you're like, did you make your own white bread? You really don't. It's kind of – fine as is.
I understand. Eddie, thank you. This has been a great primer. Thank you.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
You can taste Eddie Wong's bao at his Bao House restaurant in New York. He's the author of a memoir, Fresh Off the Boat. Scott Peacock is a Southerner. He was born and raised in Hartford, Alabama. He's a chef and a food writer. Now, what's not evident from these facts is Scott's regard for folks who've been around a lot longer than most of us. He worked with the legendary Southern cook, Edna Lewis, before she passed, And then a while ago, he started what he calls the Alabama Project. Scott, it's good to talk to you again. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to talk to you.
So what's the Alabama Project?
Well, the Alabama Project is basically, as you said, I'm from Alabama. And about a year and a half ago, I started traveling around the state looking for the oldest living Alabamians I could find in most instances and interviewing them about their earliest food memories.
So what did you discover?
The project is wonderful because we start out talking about breakfast and it leads to a great many things. And, you know, as Ms. Lewis used to say, you can't talk about Southern food without talking about Southern people. So you get these little pictures of the small details that give you this glimpse of pre-modern life in Alabama and a real glimpse into, you know, not just what people were eating, but how people were living and what it was like nearly 100 years ago. And in some cases, 100 years ago or 105 or 107 years ago.
Could we hear one of these interviews?
I'd love to. The first clip you're going to hear is a woman in Montgomery, Alabama, in her 80s named Dodgie Schaffer. And she's a woman of great style and substance, was wonderful friends with Scottie Fitzgerald, the daughter of F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, Zelda being from Montgomery. In fact, she has Zelda's signed copy of The Joy of Cooking. And she is quite a character and quite a storyteller and very intelligent. And, you know, in the South, we have certain food traditions that are revered. And Dodgie sort of tramples on one of those.
This would be heresy to almost anybody I know to hear me say what my true, deep, heartfelt feelings about cheese straws. In my opinion, cheese straws are vastly overrated. They're an institution, of course, in the South. You can't have a wedding. You can't have a funeral. You can't have a guest. You can't have anything without cheese straws. I can. I have made cheese straws. It's not worth the effort, in my opinion. I don't know where cheese straws came from. Where did they come from? I think it's one of those things like the bowl label that they brought in and it just got all over, spread all over.
Oh, she sounds like a character.
Everyone talks about cheese straws. Almost everyone talks about cheese straws, and they're a hallmark food. And everything Dodgie said, I mean, you can't have a social occasion without them. Someone gets married, someone's born,
right,
someone dies,
right.
Someone shows up with cheese straws. So, but Dodgie's very, very forthcoming and very funny and very aware of it and sends me emails signed Our Lady of the Cheese Straws.
You know, when I think of the South, I also think of cornbread.
Yes, yes. Cornbread, a great delicacy of the South, and also much more than that. I mean, it's a staple, and once was a very, very central part of the diet, even when I was growing up. But back in the childhoods of these people that I've been interviewing, it was survival, in fact. And people, generally speaking, certainly in rural areas, they grew corn, and then they would take it to the grist mill and have it ground into cornmeal. So it was readily available. Biscuits, which are a legendary Southern food, were not always available because you had to buy flour, and people, frankly, didn't always have the money to mm-hmm. buy the flour. Mm-hmm. So I think this next clip we're going to hear is Ollie Glass. And Ollie Glass is a wonderful woman from my hometown of Hartford, Alabama. She's African-American. She will be 100 this August. She still lives alone. She drives to the post office. And is very active in her senior citizens group. And she's a very strong, yet very gentle person. And she's a model to me of how to live a life of sometimes great difficulty and still remain warm and open. She worked, incidentally, during segregation. She worked for 20 years as a cook at the black high school in Hartford. She also lived in New York for 20 years. She did a lot of things. You can do a lot of things in 100 years. And the one thing that she talked about addressing the importance of cornbread was how that at breakfast time, that before they had their regular breakfast, everyone would eat a little bit of leftover cornbread from the night before. And that was to sort of help fill up before they ate their biscuit, because there might not be enough biscuit to satisfy everyone. Let's listen to this. Can you tell me about cornbread a little bit?
Oh, they make that cornbread, you know. Get that cornmeal, You had to sift it then. You don't sift a meal now. But back then you sifted to get the husk out of it and make it up with a little salt and water. And then breakfast time, we had to eat a piece of cornbread before we ate that biscuit to help fill up. So we just had a good time and had milk to drink because she'd go out and milk the cow.
Scott, she sounds wonderful.
She's a remarkable person.
So is there one more person you'd like us to meet?
There is. Jim Murphy was my father's school teacher and basketball coach in his late 80s in Slocum, Alabama. And he talked to us about a great many things about growing up and the importance of food. But it was an especially poignant moment when he talked about the connections that are made through the kitchen and in reference to his wife who had passed on several years before him. Let's listen to this.
Little things influence you all your life. Certain things that mean absolutely nothing will pop up every day just about it that you remember. Just for instance, now this is just really important. But I never, over at the sink, I never wash a butcher knife. But what, I don't think of my wife. I've seen her stand there and where the blade come out of the handle, you know. She was very careful that there was nothing left right there. So every time I wash that butcher knife, well, I think of that. And so that's where you'll be with little things that'll influence your life. And they don't, but they're a reminder of something that all the time.
Does that make you sad or happy?
It just makes me feel, I guess, still connected.
You know, Scott, this is all about those connections, as you said, that happened in the kitchen.
So moving. It still moves me. And this clip is particularly poignant and moving because Mr. Murphy just recently passed away himself.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Indeed. And I will treasure that time that we spent, and I'm so grateful to have his story recorded.
Scott, we're going to check in with you again. This is quite a project. Thanks for sharing it.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you, Lynn.
Scott Peacock is a chef and food writer living in Alabama. Somehow he felt a cheese straw recipe would be appropriate here. I can't imagine why. So, to get it, go to splendidtable.org. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. You never call my name. It is time to go to your calls and questions. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook, Pinterest, and Twitter, or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Sam is on the line from New Ulm, Minnesota. Sam, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Lynn.
You are welcome.
My question is, I'm a single guy, and so a meal that I inevitably make for myself a lot of nights is stir-fry.
Right.
You know, and I'll cook up some rice and some vegetables, maybe put in some chicken or shrimp. And my question is, inevitably, I always will use soy sauce to flavor it.
Right.
And I really like soy sauce, but I'm wondering if you have any other suggestions for other sauces or way I can flavor those stir fries, I guess.
Well, you could do a sweet sour approach.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where you would take vinegar and sugar and blend that with a bit of chicken broth and a little bit of cornstarch. So let's say, for argument's sake, you have a half a cup of chicken broth, okay? Mm-hmm. You have maybe a tablespoon of sugar, 2 tablespoons of vinegar. Mm-hmm. And it could be, ideally it's rice vinegar, but it doesn't have to be. It can be any vinegar you want. In the stir fry, what I would do you like spice?
I'm open to spice, yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, I throw a little garlic into the stir fry. One of the tricks that's used a lot in stir fries in China is that you'll chop up some garlic and you'll
Ooh.
Chop up some ginger.
Okay. Ooh.
And when you heat that oil, you know, you get the wok really hot mm-hmm. and then you swirl in that oil. And that's when you drop in that ginger and that garlic. And you just give it a few seconds. Stir it around. You don't want to burn it. But it's going to just set the flavor. And mm-hmm. then you would add whatever it is you want to stir fry. And usually what you do is you begin with something like the meat. That gets stir fried first. You take it out of the wok. You wipe it out. You just mm-hmm. put a little bit more oil in. And you could add more ginger and garlic. And then you throw in the veggies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that point, you can also throw in some fresh chilies or any other thing you want. But then what you're going to do, as you stir fry those vegetables and you're getting them to just about where you want them, you will have taken that mixture, half a cup of chicken broth, a tablespoon or so of sugar, 2 tablespoons of the vinegar, and about a teaspoon of cornstarch that you would have stirred together, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Pour that in. And make sure it comes to a boil.
Okay.
Because it's going to form this beautiful, light, glossy sauce.
Ooh.
And with that hint of the ginger and the garlic, it's going to be fabulous.
That sounds really good. I think I'm going to have to try this.
Give it a shot. Give it a shot. Now, there are tricks here. You can do vinegar and wine and sugar and broth.
Okay.
You see, you can start to vary it and play around with it. And the
sure.
other thing you can throw in is hoisin sauce, which you'll find in a lot of supermarkets.
Okay.
A tablespoon or so in that mixture. So you can vary it from night to night. Okay?
Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We've got Renee calling from Kettering, Ohio. Renee, what's up?
Good morning, Lynn. Thank you so much. I'm writing a novel, and my character loves to make pies. But she is in a tizzy, and she's decided to do something different, which is to make a cake. And her mind is elsewhere, so she's not paying attention to any of the details, and she makes a terrible muck-up. I don't cook. I don't bake. I don't do much of anything except clean up everyone else's mess. So
and I write novels. I mean, let's not knock this.
And I have no idea what terrible thing one could do to muck up a cake.
Okay. There's a couple of options you would have, and
right.
you can mix these up. Number one, she's the kind of person who keeps everything in canisters.
Right.
Right? And she has 2 canisters, each with an S on it, 1 for salt and 1 for sugar.
Right.
And she measures out the salt instead of the sugar.
Right.
So you've got 1.5 cups of salt in the cake. That's number one. That's a possibility.
All right.
Now, the other thing is, if she gets really distracted and she's using an electric mixer,
okay.
what she does is she just lets it go. And she beats the thing for like 5 minutes. Now, this is guaranteed with any cake recipe to give you a hockey puck.
Oh, sweet.
Once the flour is in there, if you beat it for 5 minutes, you'll have a good hockey puck.
Excellent.
So those are 2 really good possibilities.
Yes.
And I have done the salt and sugar.
Now, Lynn, when she does this monstrous mess of salt versus sugar,
right.
and she puts it in the oven and it's baking away, will it actually bake into
it? It
look like a cake?
I think what's going to... I did it with a mousse, with a frozen mousse.
Okay.
But I think what's going to happen is because the sugar reacts with other things, it's not going to bake quite right. It probably will rise, but she may know that something's awry. I'm not 100% sure, but I think you'd be safe saying that the cake looks odd. You know, the cake doesn't look quite right, but she takes it out of the oven. She follows the directions. She lets it cool.
Yeah.
She takes, you know, she's not going to bite into it because
no.
it's a cake, right? She
right.
frosts it, and then she cuts the slice, and all is revealed.
Very good. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. In a peripheral way, I'm very proud to be part of your novel.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate this tremendously.
Well, thank you, Renee.
Bye-bye.
Take care. 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Dean in Los Angeles writes that sardines seem to be really great food. They're nutritious, they're high in omega-3 fatty acids, they're sustainable, and they're low on the food chain, and they're even inexpensive. But the problem he has is that canned sardines, well, they have decent taste, but they're kind of bland, and they're mushy. Now, he wants to eat these several times a week, and he wants to know, what is my favorite sauce or technique to actually cook with canned sardines? Well, you know, the first place I go is pasta. And here's the deal. What you do is make a basic tomato sauce, you know, with lots of basil, a good amount of garlic, onion. You cook it for maybe 5 or 6 minutes. But when you're sautéing the onion, you take those sardines, just strip off those fillets from the bones, chop that up, and sauté that with the onion and the garlic. Get the onion kind of golden brown, add the garlic, add the sardines, add the basil. And one of the nice things to do is you then cook the tomato sauce. It's a sardine tomato sauce. And when you toss it with the pasta, toss it with a really generous squeeze of fresh lemon and some pecorino cheese. It's fabulous. Now, the other thing is, and this is a classic way of handling them, is to actually poach them lightly in a tomato sauce. So that's another, you know, angle of the same thing. The other thing that's great to do with them is to, again, get them off the bone and then throw them in the food processor with a little onion and garlic that you've let sit in lemon so they'll lose their punch, and a bit of sour cream or a little bit of mayo, something that you want that's creamy, and some chopped celery and then some fresh herbs. And then you use that as a spread. And it's really delicious. And you can pack that into crocks, and it's something you can snack on. You can spread that on thin slices of a really dense bread, have a green salad, and you have dinner. So there's two thoughts of what you can do with canned sardines. And thanks for a great question, Dean. Call us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Adam is calling from St. Paul. Adam, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question about food jobs. I love to cook,
right,
and I don't foresee myself being interested in getting a job in a restaurant as a chef, as a host, or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering, what's available out there for me?
Well, what's your educational background?
I don't have any food education.
Okay.
I have a business background.
Well, this may be a case where you might be the business end of a restaurant, which means, and it may be a case where you are creating the restaurant, creating the menu, working with a chef, overseeing the work of a chef. Now, the other thing, and this you would need to get some food science background, but you could do
okay.
that with a, you know, with a collection of courses from some of the professional schools in the area. Is,
oh, sure.
Yeah, is to start becoming a recipe tester. And you could be
Ooh.
Cooking. Yeah. Now, there's a couple of ways this can work. The way you get a salary and you have health benefits and whatever is to go to work for a large company. You know, something like, let's say, General Mills, where they're
okay.
developing recipes all the time. The other thing is that if you were living – now, St. Paul is not a bad place to be for this work – but if you're living in some place like New York City, where it is a publishing center, very often publishers are looking for people to test recipes of work that they're publishing. And between
mm-hmm.
that, and then you can learn a bit of food styling to work with photographers. And this is a craft that requires learning, but you would get a great kick out of it, I think, because it's
oh, sure.
cooking and it's art. And it's a bit of science thrown in, you know, for good measure. So three things to think about. And one is the restaurant thing is a big deal. You know, you've got to get the money and all of that. But
of course,
getting the training in food chemistry and in food preparation so that you've got solid basic skills and you've got a real knowledge of chemistry. And maybe while you're doing that, apprentice with a local food stylist and see if you can learn the ropes that way. And what I would do then is to look at, first of all, where you want to be geographically, but look at going to some of the larger companies and saying, you know, I would like very much to become someone who does recipe development. And, it's something, it's a good place to begin. Then you never know where it may go from there.
Wonderful. Thank you, Lynn.
You are very welcome. Let us know how this turns out. Okay?
Sure.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Good luck, Adam. Great food. Out of the ordinary cooking. This doesn't solely come from recipes. It comes from the techniques within the recipe. For instance, you learn to make a good stock and you can do dozens of soups. This is how Vietnamese chef and restaurateur Charles Phan thinks about cooking. Charles has the famous Slanted Door restaurant in San Francisco. Now, his first cookbook, Vietnamese Home Cooking, is a guide for anyone who wants to learn the techniques of Vietnamese cooking. Charles, good to have you.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk to you about the soup chapter, especially the technique for making the famous Vietnamese soup, the pho, you know, which is that incredibly fragrant, delicious beef broth with rice noodles, and then you have all of these things you can add, the vegetables and the seasonings. But the stock for this is everything, right?
I think if you understanding the stock, how to make them, how to harness all the flavor from your bone, your vegetable, it's super important. And this is a lot of the basis of a lot of the cooking. And yes, in fact, most people, when they think of Vietnamese food, they think of pho.
Right.
It is one of the favorite thing in the kitchen when we eat. For 17 years now, if you look at one food that the kitchen folks eat more than anything else, it's the noodle soup.
So the broth seems to be, you know, the masterpiece of this dish. How do you do that beef broth?
In Vietnam, we generally don't have oven. And we still need to figure out how to make this broth to be clear and flavorful. So instead of having an oven to roast the bone, we blanch the bone. So it looks a little funny at first. You actually blanch the bone and you throw away all the water. And
so you drop it in the – you boil it, actually.
Yes,
right?
Yes. You boil it, and I think it takes at least 30 to 60 seconds. And you literally rinse it in cold water a second time. Then you put it back in your pot, and you bring it up really slow. Never super hard boil in order to achieve this clarity.
Right.
And in order to achieve the flavor, you would have to use multiple different kinds of bone. For instance, in the beef bone, you would use the oxtail, the shank bone, the neck bone.
One of the things you do in the beef broth, which I thought was interesting, is you take a whole onion, you cut it in half, you take a chunk of ginger, and you roast it in the oven for an hour while you're blanching the bones and you know, the meat that's attached to the bones. Is that to just deepen the flavor of those ingredients, to just enrich them?
Well, what you're doing is caramelizing the onion. So you do have to, it seems kind of strange, you actually roast them first. But just like most cooking, you notice, like even a pasta sauce, you will see browning the onion first before you put the tomato in. It's sort of the same concept. You need to get that caramelization of that sugar. And the ginger also heightens when you roast these flavor, and it will come out more.
It sings when you roast it, I think. Now, the other thing that happens with this soup that's unusual, I think if you've never made an Asian soup or this Vietnamese broth or stock, is that there's a bit of sugar in it. And then you've got cinnamon and star anise and clove and cardamom. And that gets simmered in the soup. And I think that's where all those mysterious, rich flavors come into the pho. But once you've got the broth, how do you put together the pho?
Classically, when a beef pho is done with a rice noodle, never done with an egg noodle.
Right.
Egg noodle is more like a Chinese wonton import. And you can use here, you know, dry noodle or fresh rice noodle. So it's up to you. And typically, you would blanch it and not overcook the noodle, and you put it in the bowl. And first of all, you take a bowl and you heat up the bowl. Temperature is everything, so the bowl has to be warm. Then you put the noodle in and you put in your cooked meat and you put in your raw meat on top of the noodle and you put in your garnish. Then you ladle your broth on the side, not touching the raw meat, have to brought up to the raw meat.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you know, we serve with a lot of herb and different vegetable salad to create texture, like bean sprout. And we take the aromatics very seriously. So when you see the basil, the lime, we don't put them all at once. We put them in few pieces at a time and let the hot soup melt the herb so you get the aromatic flavor and the smell of the herb. Of course, you have the kind of sriracha dipping sauce on the side.
Uh-huh.
The Vietnamese sensibility is not just on the flavor of the soup, but also how you smell the fresh herb. So we like to eat a lot of salad and herb.
Charles, I can picture myself sitting over that bowl with the steam rising and the scent of those herbs. Thank you. This is wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Charles Phan is author of Vietnamese Home Cooking, and he is chef at San Francisco's The Slanted Door. Now, his recipe for that great classic soup, pho, can be found on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Elaine Boozler. She said, "Ever notice that soup for one is 8 aisles away from the party mix?" The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for more information on anything you heard here today. You can find information on our latest ebooks, podcasts, rifle through our recipe box, and register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.